Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Each episode of Keep Calm and Cook On features a meaningful interview and answers to listeners' questions about cooking. Thanks for tuning in. This episode of Keep Calm and Cook On is presented by OXO. OXO makes some of the most thoughtfully engineered tools around. To find out more about OXO, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Before I dive into today's conversation, I wanted to ask you all to visit okofarms.com, that's okofarms.com, to support Yemi Amu, who you might remember I spoke to on episode 4 of this podcast. Oko Farms is in the process of raising $50,000 because they can no longer operate at their current location, and they're moving to the Weeksville Heritage Center, a historic Black museum in Brooklyn. I personally appreciate any and all help you can send Yemi's way. She's an important member of our community, and the link to her farm is in the show notes. Speaking of important New Yorkers, I am thrilled to share my conversation with the one and only Bonnie Slotnick. Bonnie is a New York legend who has run her shop, Bonnie Slotnick Cookbooks, for 23 years. She specializes in out-of-print and antiquarian books, and I spoke to her recently at her shop in the East Village. I've been shopping at Bonnie's for years and have come to enjoy hearing her opinions and getting her perspective on all things cookbooks and running a small business. Most of all, I enjoy getting to talk to anyone who has committed themselves to something for decades, anyone who's passionate about what they do, and anyone who lives on their own terms. This is Bonnie, and I am so happy for you to listen to her story. Can you take me back to when you opened? How did the store start? How come you wanted to open it?
Well, the store starts with me lying under the dining room table at age 7 or 8, reading my mother's settlement cookbook, which was one of maybe 3 cookbooks that my mother had that were kept in a kitchen cabinet out of sight, out of mind. And at some point, I picked up that book and started reading it. I can show you. I have an entire shelf of them. It's a book that was very popular among Jewish women it was first published at the very beginning of the 20th century. And her copy was from the mid-40s when she got married. Hadn't changed that much. It was a book that was put together by a group of women who ran a settlement house in Milwaukee. And they were German-Jewish women. And so it was a mixture of the recipes they were teaching to the people in the settlement house who they were teaching to become American and have marketable skills. That and kind of probably upper-middle-class home recipes. And I would turn the pages and it would say, you know, matzah meal pudding, and then 10 pages later it would be oysters Rockefeller and pork a la this and ham a la that. And I grew up in a kosher home, and this was so confusing to me. But it was so, I always would use the word exotic when I describe this, that these things were together and these things were so foreign and the other things were so familiar. Some of the recipes were, the recipe titles were in Yiddish and they weren't translated. Everybody knew. And it had some charming little drawings. In the front, it had directions for, I think it was in the front, lighting a coal stove, lighting a wood stove, lighting an oil stove. We had a hot point electric range. I didn't know what that was about. And then there were chapters on invalid cooking, which was old cookbooks up to maybe the 30s pretty commonly had chapters on cooking for people who were sick, because people who were sick were home. They weren't sent away somewhere.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up mostly in Lakewood, New Jersey.
Okay, so you're under the dining room table in New Jersey.
Yes, when probably my father was mowing the lawn and I was kind of hiding, or I don't know, I just liked it under there.
Yeah. Did it feel like safe?
Safe,
it
sounds like, yeah. I mean, they say that dogs like to have something over their head.
Uh-huh.
And that's why dogs like to lie under a table or under a chair.
I get that.
I like that.
Yeah, so you were in your kind of safe place with these books, and it sounds like it was very, like, you could imagine yourself maybe in these stories, or
yes,
you get
yes,
kind of
I
lost
wanted
in them.
A church yeah. wedding, a great shock to my parents. I worked at Parsons. I worked at the library. Then I thought, have to do something else, blah, 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 a couple of years. And I decided I wanted to be in cookbook publishing. Just woke up one morning and said, I'm very good at language. I'm very interested in cookbooks. There must be a job. And I found a job within 2 weeks of that at a little company called Rebus, which was one of the earlier book packagers, and did very soon got into desktop publishing. The first year I worked there, we didn't have computers. So I was typing recipes, mm-hmm. and I was typing carbons.
On
a
typewriter.
On an IBM Selectric, state of the art. And then it was such a small company that everybody did everything. The staff of they also did books, some books on other subjects, but there was a whole cookbook department. It was maybe six people. So from the beginning, I started not just typing, but I was proofreading, and then I was copy editing, and then I was correcting proofs, and this was paper proofs mm-hmm. era, you know, sending things out to be typeset and then making corrections on them. And then I started writing a little bit. And again, because it was such a small company, I would also bring in my own vintage kitchen things to prop photo shoots. And very occasionally, we did our food photography right in the office. I sat right outside the studio. We had our own prop department. And the test kitchen director was Grace Young, who has gone on to be very successful as a cookbook author.
How cool.
At about the same time, that was 1984, 85, Kitchen Arts and Letters opened. Mm-hmm. And one of my coworkers there had been to the store, and she said, go up to Kitchen Arts and Letters. You and Nach will love each other. I'm sure you'll have some common ground. So I did that, and we did. And I said, you know, I spend all my spare time in old bookstores looking for cookbooks. And he had customers coming in, even from the beginning, who were looking for books that were out of print. They didn't know they were out. People just figure, you know, I bought this book 20 years ago. I need a new one. Mm-hmm. The publisher will supply me with a new one. So I started making a list of the customer requests that he had. And this was all done on paper. The whole time I was there, everything was done on paper. I handwrote a list on a legal pad. It got longer and longer. And when I added to it, I would copy out the whole thing again, and I began to remember it. And that's still kind of how I run the store. I remember what books people have asked for, although I do have a file. So I started going out book hunting in the city on my day off, on weekends, whatever. And I have a friend who lives in Cambridge, Mass., Robin Bledsoe, who's had a bookstore for 35 years now. And she sells art books and books about horses. So we were able to take road trips together and never get in each other's way because we weren't looking at
that's ideal.
The other. And we had fantastic times on the road and, you know, helpless laughing fits and
like
strange
and
motel rooms that, you know, that we never did, but we did often cite, once the movie came out, whatever year that was, we often cited them in our conversations. I was finding books for customers and then
for Kitchen Arts and
for
Letters.
For Kitchen
customers.
Arts and Letters, I was there for 12 years altogether, and Nach and I were partners. We figured out a financial way to do that. Although I wasn't supposed to be in the store when the store was open, so I worked on Sundays. And my routine was to walk up there from 10th Street.
That's a long walk.
And lock myself in and work in the back. And that was the same happy place as under the dining room table was that little back office, Kitchen Arts and Letters. I walked up there in blizzards, walked up there when it was 95 degrees and back. And it was my little kingdom. And I started to accumulate stock. And by the time I left, there are two rooms in the basement, two storerooms, and one of them was filled with out-of-print books. And when we decided that it was time for me to fly, I took that stock with me. I bought it out. And opened my own store while still having, I think I was working 4 days a week at that point, working at home one day, but no experience running a business, no idea of what it meant to have a commercial lease. Mm-hmm. I had had the same landlord since 1976, and this was 1997. So it was a real shock when he told me I had to be out the next day, that November afternoon. And I sent out little handwritten press releases. I made these little cards, and I put a little canning jar sticker on each one, and I wrote the date. And I guess I also had printed out a sheet describing what the store was going to be. And that was the thing that Florence Fabricant saw and called me. And that was really the floodgates opened. Every, you know, New York Times Syndicate papers, of course, but then all these other papers picked it up. And then other publications, this was in the paper days, mm-hmm. you know, magazine editors and editors from other newspapers, writers called me. And I was famous, and I still couldn't be open more than weekends and evenings by appointment.
Because you were still
had your day job. Working, mm-hmm. yeah. And then after, I guess, in like a year and a half into that, I was walking on West 10th Street, a block from where I live, and I saw a sort of a storefront for sale. It was an old front apartment of a tenement building up a few steps for rent. It was for rent. And I thought, that's it. That's, you know, Victorian building. I have to get that. So it was about a third more rent than I was paying. And I had to move. And it was in terrible condition. And I just decided to do it again, like, duh, why? And suddenly I was a full-time bookseller.
Wow.
With a kind of half-furnished, but with a lot of books. I had about 2,000 books when I started the store. And each time I've moved, and I ain't moving no more, I've had probably double.
Yeah. The space we're sitting in now, how many books are we surrounded by, more or
I
less?
I say 5,000, wow, but okay. I don't have an inventory, much to the distress of my insurance company, who I convinced to accept photographs as my inventory. My store is not about fine, rare, antiquarian. Uh-huh. They've gotten so expensive,
yeah.
And the collectors of them are, there's some very wealthy people collecting cookbooks. And they're not going to come here, and I can't invest in that kind of book.
Yeah.
If somebody offers me a valuable book, I usually take it on consignment rather than paying for it outright. And sometimes it just doesn't sell, and I give it back to them.
What would you say, so if that's not what your store is about, what is your store about? What do you stand for, and what do you sell? And I guess, who do you sell to?
My store is about, it's not so much I have everything for the cook,
mm-hmm.
or I have everything for the chef. My store is for people who love cookbooks for whatever reason. Can be a novelist who needs background for something, you know, book that takes place in the 40s, or a chef who's looking for something obscure,
mm-hmm.
some part of Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, to somebody who's going home to make dinner for their family, to somebody bringing in a child who they want to start cooking or who has shown an interest, to people who just like to sit and read cookbooks. And that so many of my customers have that, you know, I read them like novels, or I read them like detective stories, or occasionally I read them like porn, people will say. There's just something about reading recipes, the modern, you know, the aspirational books, the books of dishes that you'll never cook,
mm-hmm.
and fabulous photographs. That's one kind of cookbook reading. And then there's my kind, the older books, the time travel. The just wondering at how someone could take a recipe from, say, the 18th century, and know what to do with, you know, you can read, I have facsimiles. I don't have books from the 18th century at the moment, but the recipes seem so sketchy, you know, nothing is measured for one thing. And that is, to me, it's like reading a delicious novel.
Yeah. I always find those types of recipes from older books so interesting because I read them with the understanding that it was assumed people just knew how to cook. So it's, you know, people writing these descriptions for people who know what they mean.
Yeah, and
you
they
know,
also,
there's not so much explanation because I'm assuming there didn't have to be, you know.
Right.
Which is
and
interesting to me.
Increases and increases through the 20th century. I mean, Fanny Farmer with her level measurements.
Yeah.
Did I say Fanny Farber? I think I'd like to say
which
Fanny Farmer.
Which who I was thinking about with your, I'll have to take a picture of your pin.
Oh,
you're
somebody
wearing
just
an amazing
gave me this.
Pin that's measuring spoons.
Little silver measuring
that's
spoons.
That's so cute.
I was thinking, I think measuring spoons, this may be telling, are my favorite piece of cooking equipment because I love to bake. You don't need measuring spoons to cook so much. Not really. But I love those little plastic clickety-clackety plastic, each spoon a different color, which is what I grew up with. And the sound of baking.
You have them right there.
The sound of baking is, to some extent, this. Here comes the vanilla. Here comes the baking powder.
And I think that was my first sound effect. Fantastic.
Well, I love it. There's something about this quality of plastic.
In the year of 2019, I mean, you've seen so much change
it's
in
2019? I thought it was 1939. I was so happy. Jeez, you burst my bubble.
You're too funny. I'm so sorry to be the messenger.
I didn't know what you, when you said 2000, I thought, what comes after that? 19.
But what do you think today is the role of a store like yours? To me, it's more than just selling books.
It's it's a lot more than just selling books. And selling books is not a a profit machine. What I love about this, and I think what my customers love, and what they tell me, is that they just love being here. Maybe I should have been a set decorator or an interior designer or something. But people who come in for the first time will say, you know, this is my new favorite place in the world. I had people who came in to my old store after 9/11 and just sat and looked at books, and I knew that they weren't going to buy anything. They just wanted the comfort that you get from old cookbooks.
Mm-hmm. Under the dining room table.
We're all under the dining room table. We're all in the same. And now this, I try to keep this as a politics-free zone, except for the sign in the window, which people keep stopping to take pictures of. I think it must be Instagrammed all over the world. I have a facsimile of an old Campbell's soup sign, which was an American flag formed out of Campbell's soup cans. It was a piece of advertising from probably the early 20th century. And I hung it upside down. And I wrote that displaying the flag upside down is a sign of distress, you know, in naval flag lore. Mm-hmm. And the sign also says, Campbell's soup, just add hot water. And I refer to the fact that hot water seems appropriate for what's going on now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I put signs out there. If people don't like what they indicate, they don't have to come in. But I don't bring up politics in the store. I have customers from all over the country. And some of them, if they knew my feelings about what's going on, they probably would just huff out. But I do have customers from all over the country, all over the world. I've gotten written up in the paper world, in guidebooks in Japan and Korea, China, I think, but also in magazines, and now, of course, also online and Instagram. And I ask people not to use their phones in the store. That's the second sign people sometimes take exception to. It says, if you can't shop without your phone in your hand, please shop somewhere else. And I'm not saying that if you get a call and you're a doctor that you can't pick up the call. But people sometimes walk in with their phone in their hand in front of their face, and all they've come in to do is take a video or take pictures, or that it's like they're the private paparazzo of the person they're with who must be photographed in the store, or they're just people who have totally become unaccustomed to just looking at things with their eyes, absorbing it, and keeping it as a memory. I don't think these people have any memories in their brains, but they're all too happy to flip through 10,000 pictures and show you where you've been or post it.
If you didn't take a picture, it didn't happen.
Right. That is really true now, or a film. And then there are people who come in and photograph a book that they want. And there are several reasons for doing that. If it's a book that has a barcode, they can order it on Amazon directly, right? That's second. Or in the way that 20 years ago, somebody might have kept a little notebook and written down books they were interested in. They take a picture of the book. And then there are people who open the book and take pictures of the information that they want or the design. I had somebody come in, the people who make the cards with the menu designs also make prints, and I used to have small matted prints. And a young man in his 20s came in with his mother, sat down on the floor, and systematically took 20 prints out of the box one by one and photographed them. And I said, what are you doing? And his mother said, oh, he's a design student. He's just doing some research. I said, well, this is a family business. These people make their money by choosing and having these things printed, and they're not free. People do not understand this anymore. Everything is free. Everything belongs to, if you have a camera, whatever is in front of you belongs to you. And I don't like that in relation to books, and I don't like it in relation to anything else. I don't like it when somebody is FaceTiming or whatever. I don't have a smartphone, and I don't want to have a smartphone. But when they're talking and I'm walking past them and I'm in their movie too, I will sometimes lean in and movie. That was funny. Say something inappropriate.
Ooh, what do you
say? Or the people... Not for publication. Or just like, hi, she's in New York. People in my gym. Sometimes everybody in the gym is on the phone, and all the people who are taking breaks between sets of weightlifting are staring at their phone. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes come over and say, stay hydrated. Or that burns a lot of calories. Or I can't.
Yeah.
And it's not just the young folks.
Yeah.
Are people my age who are squinting at their phones because they're farsighted, but they have to punch one little number at a time and whatever they're doing. So sometimes I feel like I have the whole gym to myself because nobody is looking up.
Yeah, no one, they're there, but they're not there.
So even more than usual, I don't care how I look. Yeah. It's kind of nice.
How often do you go to the gym?
Sometimes I go 6 days a week, sometimes I go every other day. When I'm really feeling good, I will instead ride my bike as far as I can.
Yeah.
I would like to take a vacation someday, and I think it would like to be someplace I could ride my bike and feel safe for 100 miles.
When was the last time you took a vacation?
1997.
Wow.
That was before I opened the store.
Where'd you go?
I went to Ireland, and I sing in a choir, and at the time, my friends were singing in this particular choir called Amor Artis, and they had been doing tours in the summers, and I didn't join the choir, but I signed up for the summer to go to Ireland. I arranged to go there about a week early and stayed on a horse farm and rode every day. And it was heaven. Hmm. Maybe that's why I have not died from lack of vacation in the past 23 years. but I sure would like to take a vacation again. I just can't figure out how to do it. I have, as I was telling you, I have lots of people who volunteer to work for me, and they're usually hugely overqualified, and they want some sort of normal job where they would have their own desk or something. And my way of running the store doesn't really leave physical space for another person, or emotional or psychological, mental space for another person. So I guess I would just have to close.
Yeah.
And my customers would just have to realize that I needed a break.
Yeah. I feel like
someday.
I think they might understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless they show up at my door and then they leave me a phone message and say, I came all the way from and you weren't here. Or there are people who come in and say, I've walked past here a million times and you're never open.
Mm.
Fighting words.
A million. It's a lot.
A million, that's a lot. You know? I live next door and I say, big smile. Why don't you try coming when I'm open?
Yeah. Yeah. During those hours that are posted.
Yeah.
I asked actually this question to Matt Sartwell at Kitchen Arts and Letters.
I listened to your interview with
him.
Awesome. I didn't think I had that much to say, but obviously finding my words.
I'm so curious your answer about this, especially since you do not sell new cookbooks. Do you think the world needs another cookbook?
I hate to say this to a very successful cookbook author, but
no,
not really.
Yeah, that's okay. I can take that.
Or at least publishers have to be a little more selective about what they publish. To me, it seems like the way of publishing now is that people have a blog. The blog gets a huge following. They either get offered a book contract or sometimes they self-publish. And then if that is successful, then I think that's legitimate and there's a demand for the book and there's a following. The people who are just cranking out books, I still get the catalog from Edward R. Hamilton up in Connecticut, and that's also the dump of all the bad cookbooks, and I cannot believe they send out several times a year just a cookbook catalog. It's probably 80 pages, and it's whatever, you know, 24 paleo Instapot books have come out. How could that possibly be necessary?
Yeah.
And how could you possibly figure out which one, if any, had any value at all? You know, I used to be able to buy my books just fine from a catalog when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. They were well described. But there's this just push to get product out there. And people bring me, I buy my books from individual people who are either heirs to a collection or a downsizing, change the way they eat, just quote unquote, I just don't cook anymore. That's sad. I hear that a lot. Or they're moving, or Marie Kondo has gotten to them and she don't like your books. And they sometimes say, can I just bring you all of my books? I just want to get rid of them. So they'll bring me several boxes of books. I'll choose maybe five lovely books that were published when Judith Jones was at Knopf, you know, the Paula Wolfords and the Claudia Rodens and the Julia Childs, of course. And the rest of them will be that paleo muffin, keto bomb, whatever that stuff is called. And a few years ago, I met the librarian from the local public school here on 3rd Street. And they have a cookbook collection there. They have like the official cookbook collection of the New York Public School System.
That's pretty cool.
And it's mostly actual children's cookbooks, but also some just basic books and books to cook with family. And we decided to have a cookbook sale. So I started giving her that overflow from what I was buying and then what was just left to me. Well, last year, we had about six boxes of books. This year, there are already 12 big cartons of books in the library. There's six more here, and I put a shelf on this little book truck of books that I'm selling to benefit whatever I get for them, I'll give her. But there's a limit to who will even take cookbooks as a donation. The, you know, Housing Works gets 1 million books a week, mm-hmm. from what I can tell. Everybody says, oh, I'll just take them to Housing Works. City Opera Thrift Shop on East 23rd Street has a cookbook event every year, and they collect cookbooks all year. And then they also have kitchenware. They do the whole, they have a sort of mezzanine or second floor of the store. And they have tableware and cookbooks, and it's great. And City Opera needs the money, still paying off the old debts. But other than that, you know, you can't give them away.
Yeah.
Some of those bad books. I actually get kind of angry that they exist, because I love trees.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not just
it's
the
a lot trees, of paper.
It's the shipping, mm-hmm. and the Amazon delivery and the instant gratification. If you decide you're going to eat, you're going to be vegan, you don't really need 25 books right away to start. And over 10 years, the ones that are good, that held their value, that held their quality, will still be good. Mm-hmm. You don't need a new one every week. But I think that's partly that whole instant gratification of the company that starts with Emma and ends mm-hmm. with Zahn, is that not only do I need this and I must have it, but I must have it now.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of books that people sell me are books that they bought online,
yeah.
that they didn't really have any chance to
yeah.
look at before they bought. And I guess I know people are doing it here, but the reason that the cookbook library in Los Angeles closed was, as the owner, Ellen Rose, said, people were coming in, looking at books, as they do with everything. They do with audio equipment. They do with sneakers. They go into a store, and they look at it, and then they order it online. Mm-hmm. And she just, her income just disappeared.
Yeah.
She was selling new books, and it's way too easy. I don't know what people are doing with all their stuff. Everybody
yeah.
has too much stuff.
Yeah.
I guess in a way, Amazon created Marie Kondo.
It's like its own vicious cycle. Yeah, people, I think, are photographing the stuff and putting it on Instagram while they're on the treadmill at your gym. And, you
yeah.
know, it's all...
Yeah.
It's really interesting talking to you about this, sitting in your store surrounded by these thousands of books and hearing what...
one too many.
Yeah, no, not at all. And hearing what the books have meant to you and kind of what you encourage when people come in here, because to me it sounds like it just comes back over and over to just being really present. You know, when you read the book, it kind of transports you somewhere. And even hearing about you being in the choir, like when you're singing, like, or if you're riding a bicycle in New York, you have to be present. So
you,
it sounds like that's something that's really important to you.
On your phone while
yeah.
you're singing. One
yeah.
of our tenors always has his phone in his hand.
Must drive you crazy.
I know he has 2 children and I guess a very important job, but he's
yeah.
always kind of taking it out of
yeah.
his pocket at hip level and looking down.
Yeah.
There. Yeah, the everybody-ness of everybody's eyes are somewhere else. I always say that I am uncomfortable with people who don't have strong opinions,
mm.
and especially people who don't know what they like. People who say, get me a yogurt, I don't care what flavor. I only like one flavor of yogurt.
Which
plain
one?
Plain and
okay.
coffee.
I
don't
had
like
a coffee
none of that
yogurt
fruit
and
shit. Well, I lived on it when I was in college.
Yeah, my mom used to get it when I was... My mom used to buy coffee yogurt from Jefferson Market because I grew up on West 14th Street.
Uh-huh.
And we used to... I have a piece of paper over my desk that's framed that's... my mom worked since before I was born, so going grocery shopping wasn't something she had time to do. So she made a list of the things we most commonly consumed in our house.
Uh-huh.
And every week she would go through the list and check off what we needed.
Uh-huh.
And call in the order to Jefferson Market, and that's how we got groceries when I was growing up. But yeah, that's a sidebar. But coffee yogurt, that was just, I could taste it when you just said that.
Dan and coffee yogurt.
Yeah. So you like plain and coffee, and
I
you like people with opinions.
Plain.
Yeah.
And I don't like people, you know, I don't care what color, I don't care what flavor. It doesn't really matter what, sometimes people come in, they're buying a gift, and they don't really care, except they want something kind of impressive.
Uh-huh.
And I've actually had a few times when I will offer to gift wrap a book, which I love to do, and I'll take out my eraser and say, let me erase the price before I forget. And they go, you know, maybe don't erase the price.
Ooh. Yeah. Do you cook at home a lot?
I make my own meals.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if, you know, so many people come in and say, are you a chef? Uh-huh. You must be a wonderful cook. Da-da-da-da. I make the food that I eat.
Yeah.
I think I have the record for New York City for having lived in an apartment for 43 years and never had food delivered.
Wow.
Except once when I was testing a recipe for Rebus, they were, must have been really desperate that they asked me to test a recipe. And I didn't have brown sugar. And of course, I live a block from where Jefferson Market was, and we had an account. And I had them deliver a box of brown sugar. But
Rebus had the account.
Rebus, yeah. Balducci's. Mm-hmm. I live between Balducci's and Jefferson Market. So sometimes I got the card and I got to go pick out a $16 box of raspberries in the middle of January.
So once you had a box of brown sugar delivered.
I did.
No,
but I've never had
takeout.
Pizza, Chinese, nothing. I rarely get that stuff. I have a system where as I'm riding my bike home, I usually work pretty late, and I eat when I get home, and it's almost always 11 o'clock.
Oh, wow.
So I don't want a big meal, and I don't want to cook. So I start thinking about what I have in the refrigerator and what will taste good, and I was a Charlie Brown line, never get your mouth ready for a jelly bread sandwich when there's no jelly. So I make sure that I don't do
that. Words of wisdom,
Don't think about something with cheese if I know that I just finished the kind of cheese that I want to eat. So, you know, in the summer, I make salads, I make pasta, I cook eggs. I eat totally random things that are totally the privilege of people who live alone and are not on a webcam while they're eating and are not photographing their food. And then I always have chocolate ice cream.
Every night?
Life is short,
I love that.
Last night I had coffee ice cream because I was out on the town here in the East Village. I love Davey's ice cream on First Avenue. They have their coffee, ice cream is called Strong Coffee, and it has ground coffee in it.
Oh, wow.
And I got a child's portion so that I wouldn't be up all night.
I was about to ask, did you go to sleep?
Well, for one scoop of ice cream, I could do it. It's just kind of a thrilling flavor, to use a very popular food word now. I think William Grimes introduced that in the New York Times. I think he's responsible for thrilling. Or maybe Frank Bruni.
I feel like you have a really cool life. It sounds like you're doing what you want. Is that accurate?
We don't have to psychoanalyze the other parts of my life that are less. Yeah, I do. I get to do what I love every day. That's the main thing. I never dread coming to work. It helps that I don't have to be here at 8:30 in the morning.
You've sort of carved out your own terms.
Market. Yeah. And I know how lucky I am that I could do that. I felt that way when I worked in publishing, too.
Yeah.
I loved it.
My last question I wanted to ask you, which is just my favorite fun question that I ask everyone, is what was your favorite thing to eat when you were growing up? What was on top of the dining room table that you were laying underneath of?
It wasn't on top of the dining room table frequently enough, but my mother made a chocolate cake for our birthdays, which was a recipe from the Swansdown flour box.
The cake flour.
And the red box with the swan on it. Now very stylized, used to be a little more of a realistic swan. And the recipe was this new method where you mix the flour and the sugar, and then you beat in the softened butter. I still make the cake. I don't always use that method. Sometimes I just use a regular creaming method. The whole cake, two-layer, 9-inch cake, calls for 2 ounces of unsweetened chocolate. The frosting, which was from a little Philadelphia cream cheese booklet, is a cream cheese chocolate frosting, which is so delicious, which also calls for a mere 2 ounces of unsweetened chocolate. And, of course, vanilla to compliment. I hope that's not too loud.
Oh, no.
And now that I make the cake, I usually double the frosting recipe and I add half a stick of butter because it used to... I can't believe we had the cake around long enough, but the frosting would dry and crack like mm-hmm. plaster. And then, of course, you could pick up pieces of it from the cake plate and eat them alone. But that was our birthday cake and very special occasions. We never had pie on Thanksgiving. My mother never made a pie that I know of. But my birthday is very close to Thanksgiving. And we had company, and we had that chocolate cake for dessert, which was also maybe a bit of an issue at one point because obviously Thanksgiving dinner is meat
yeah.
and cream cheese frosting it's and a cake dairy. Made with milk is dairy, but I guess they were pretty loose about that. The keeping kosher was more my mother's thing than my father's. But the best thing was that we were allowed to have cupcakes for breakfast on our birthdays. Maybe that only happened once, but in my memory...
It stayed.
It was every year, and I still love to make cupcakes with that recipe and deconstruct, you know, the whole thing. Still did that when I was eating Hostess cupcakes in school. But, oh, this is so good. This cake is so tender.
Thank you so much, good. Bonnie. I'm so happy you're here.
Did we talk about cookbooks?
Yeah, for sure.
Ever wonder if a product you love will hang in there for the long haul? OXO thinks about this all of the time, and that's why they test their products endlessly to make sure they'll withstand years of wear and tear. What does that look like? Take their handheld spiralizer, a handy device that turns zucchini into noodles and potatoes into ribbons and so on. To speed up its testing process, Mac, one of OXO's product engineers, added a drill bit attachment to the food holder of the spiralizer. He was able to spiralize vegetables in record speeds and simulate how users would use the spiralizer over many years. For more about OXO and their products, head to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. And now it is time to answer listeners' questions about cooking. And my wife, Grace, is back from her trip, so she is going to ask today's questions. And remember, if you have a question for me, you can DM me on Instagram at Tertian or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. Grace, all yours.
Hey, JT. Okay, so fall is upon us, and your first question comes from Michelle in New York City, who says that she is heading up here to our area to go apple picking soon in the Hudson Valley and wants to know if you have any good ideas for cooking or recipes using apples.
Okay, I have a few ideas just off the top of my head. The first is to make applesauce. Might sound really basic, but applesauce is delicious. I think it's super underrated. My favorite way to make it is to just roughly chop your apples. You don't have to peel or seed them. Just chop them and put them in the oven on a big sheet pan or a big, you know, roasting dish and just roast them till they're really soft. You can put a splash of water in the pan. If you want to add some sugar or brown sugar, you can, but it really doesn't need it at all. You could put some cinnamon. Again, nice, but you don't need it. And then once those apples are soft and cooked down, just pass them through a food mill. Roasting them kind of increases their apple flavor, and cooking them like that is just like a lot less work because there's no peeling, no seeding. Then that applesauce you can eat on its own. It's delicious with some yogurt. That's how my mom eats it, or like a dollop of sour cream on top. Also, so good served with like a roast pork or grilled pork chops. And the other favorite thing I love to do with lots of apples is to use applesauce in applesauce cake. I did a recipe for an applesauce cake in my last cookbook, Now and Again. I will link to it in the show notes. It is the easiest cake. It's so good. So I highly recommend that. One other idea is just good old baked apples. Dory Greenspan just did a great piece about this in the New York Times Magazine in a recipe, so I've linked to that too. I love a baked apple. So good, kind of old-fashioned, but really homey. And again, not too much work. So those are a couple ideas.
Okay, JT, so you got a lot of questions about recommendations for where to go, where to eat, what to do when people are up in the Hudson Valley this fall, whether they're leaf peeping or picking apples. So I thought you and I could go back and forth sharing some of our favorite recommendations for where we live, which is Ulster County.
Okay, Grace, where is your favorite place to go pick apples or do any apple-related activity?
So we're lucky, and we have a couple really great family-owned farms in our area that either allow you to pick apples or buy apples that have been pre-picked by people from the farm. So Westwind Orchard, which is in Acord, New York, which is pronounced Accord, but looks like Honda Accord, is a great place to start. You can also get pizza there, and you will probably run into a ton of people from New York City because it tends to be a hangout. The next place I would recommend is Sonderskill, which is another family-owned farm, also in Accord. And then there's another family-owned farm called Davenport, and I believe that you can just buy apples there, but they have an excellent selection of local produce, and that is located in Stone Ridge. Okay, JT, so those are some family farms. What about places to eat in town? So let's just pick anywhere in Ulster County that's like roughly a 2.5 hour drive north of New York City for anybody who's traveling.
Okay, the first place that comes to mind, my absolute favorite place, is Top Taste, which is in Kingston. It is a wonderful Jamaican restaurant run by the sweetest couple, Sammy and Melinda. I've actually gotten to write about them before, so I'll link to that in the show notes. If you want excellent jerk chicken that's like long smoked or jerk pork, it's your place. If you want just like a really friendly smile, they are your people. They are the best. I cannot recommend Top Taste more highly.
Okay, I want to throw in more restaurants. So my favorite place to eat, and this is our go-to when we go to a movie sometime on the weekends, is to eat at Diego's Taqueria, which is in Kingston. And it's owned by this awesome couple, Isaac and Elena Cruz. And I think what I love most about them is not only that their food is great, which we love, but they're just really, really nice people. And I think part of the charm of coming up here is really getting to know the people who run the restaurants up here. So I'm going to recommend Diego's next.
And when you said tacos in Kingston, I think not only of them, but also of Mi Pueblito. It's such a good place. So good. I will link to that as well in the show notes. A few other ideas. If you are in the High Falls, kind of Stone Ridge area, I will also mention Egg's Nest in High Falls, Kitchenette. Those are really fun places. In Stone Ridge, there's Hash, which is wonderful for breakfast and for lunch. We really, really love breakfast there. Also, The Roost is really fun. And then there's the new Stonehouse Tavern in Accord. We're super excited about that. It's run by a woman that we know through working with her in our local food pantry. She's wonderful. So that is a place we're really excited about. And Grace, what if you go south to like Ellenville? Where would you recommend?
So there are three places that you and I love in Ellenville. And I feel like Ellenville doesn't always get a lot of love when people talk about the Hudson Valley, but it's a really great town. And it's got three restaurants that we love. Gabby's, which is a Mexican restaurant that's excellent. A Korean restaurant called Sook House, which is so awesome. And then there's also a Dominican restaurant that I believe is right across the street from the Rite Aid. Once you get to Ellenville, you pretty much will see all of these on the main drag. And the Dominican restaurant is really awesome for takeout. We've gotten like their stewed chicken before. Really great to bring back to the house and then kind of finish off the rest of the meal if you're like renting a place and staying up here for the weekend.
And I cannot believe we've named so many places and I haven't named one of my all-time favorite places in the world, which is Cherry's, which is our local kind of ice cream, burger, hot dog, grilled cheese joint. It's right on 209, kind of in between Stone Ridge and Accord. Excellent ice cream, excellent vibes, excellent toppings, an excellent turkey Reuben. Our go-to date is to split the turkey Reuben and fries. We each get a small ice cream. Doesn't take much to make us happy, which is really wonderful. So I think those are all great food ideas. I'm going to give this back to you if you can recommend any like activities, like things to do, you know, maybe some things to do so that you can really enjoy that ice cream afterwards.
So if you are in Ulster County and you've been all day picking apples or you're just up here and want a few more things to do, we have a couple favorites. So the first one, I'm going to recommend the Rosendale Movie Theater as well as Upstate Films, which owns and operates two different art movie theaters, one in Woodstock, New York, one in Rhinebeck, which is technically a different county across the river, but both excellent places to see really great movies that are both community owned and run, which is awesome. We love Rosendale. If you're there, you can eat at the Big Cheese and you can pick up sandwiches or soups or coffee right next door to the movie theater. And if you are up for something a little more active, Julia, what's our favorite place to do that?
Our favorite place for activity, hands down, is 30 Minutes of Everything, which is a wonderful exercise studio right on Route 209 in Accord. It is run by our friend Tanya. I can say, I know this sounds really like hyperbolic, but I mean it. It has changed my life. I love going to 30 Minutes of Everything. It's the best exercise class ever. It's like so welcoming. There's no judgment. I feel stronger than I've ever felt in my life. I am so happy to endorse 30 Minutes of Everything. And on Saturday mornings, Tanya does drop-in classes, so you don't have to sign up for a whole session. So if you're in this area, definitely come by. You'll probably see Grace and I there doing all sorts of push-ups and all these things that make us feel really good about ourselves.
And if you want to just sort of get a great view of the area, go for a hike, be sure to check out the Mohonk Preserve. You can also actually hike on the grounds at the Mohonk Mountain House, which is sort of a beloved, ginormous family-owned hotel, which is in between New Paltz and Accord. And if you don't want to stay there overnight, because it can be a little bit pricey, but a fun place to splurge if you feel like it, you can actually just pay to get your car in the parking lot, and then you have access to all of their grounds, which in the winter you can do snowshoeing and skiing and ice skating. You can also just get a day pass and go hiking and enjoy their views, which are incredible.
And Grace, say you're going there and you're driving either through New Paltz on the way there or through New Paltz on the way back to, you know, New York City or wherever you're coming or going from. Where would you stop in New Paltz?
My favorite place, owned by Lagusta Yearwood, is called Commissary, and it's an incredible sort of vegan forward place to get lunch. I believe they also have dinner some nights, and just really, really great coffee. They have an amazing zine library. It's one of my favorite places to hang out in New Paltz.
Yeah, and Lagusta's actually going to be on an upcoming episode, so you're going to hear a lot more about her and her businesses. It is vegan, forward, backwards, every direction. It's really special. Also, some of the best chocolates I've ever had in my life. And I'm going to give one last plug in New Paltz, and it's to Gattoletto's, which is my beloved seafood store. So if you're in this area, you live here, you're renting a house, something, and you want to cook like an awesome seafood dinner, stop at Gattoletto's to get all your fish and seafood. I think that would be just a great weekend. I think those are great suggestions. I will write all of this down, put it in the show notes, so you can, you know, click on all those links. Grace, thank you so much for your insight about our area and for being the voice of the listeners.
Anytime, and I'll see you at Cherry's.
And a quick word before I go via the advice on Bonnie's website. If you live in New York City, please support the City Council action on the Small Business Jobs Survival Act, known as SBJSA. You can find out all you need to know at savenyc.nyc. That's SAVENYC.NYC. The link is also in the show notes. And one more quick reminder to support Oko Farms. That link is also in the show notes. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Keep Calm and Cook On. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you have a few extra seconds, please rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. And let someone know about it. Post about it on social media, text a friend about the show, email your family. It all adds up. Keep Calm and Cook On is produced and hosted by me, Julia Tertian, and engineered by David Tatasciore. For more about David, head over to davetat.com. And for more about me and my work and my cookbooks, head over to juliatertian.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Tertian. Thanks again for listening. This episode of Keep Calm and Cook On is presented by OXO. OXO makes some of the most thoughtfully engineered tools around. To find out more about OXO, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com.